Hi again. I am Jack Murtha, and this is Databook.
Databook is a healthcare analytics news podcast, and I'm Tom Castles.
So before we start, you can check us out online at hcanews.com. And obviously, we are also on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn.
And definitely don't forget to sign up for our email newsletter. That's how you can make sure you get the best news, features, and insights that we have to offer.
So we have a pretty decent show for you today. First off, our guest is Janae Sharp.
We'd like to welcome her back. This is her second time on Databook. Janae is a health IT expert and KOL who is on the rise. She's here to discuss a disturbing story, and it's all thanks to healthcare's broken information system.
The lackluster growth of interoperability, which, as you know, is the ability to send and receive data between different computer systems or electronic health record systems. EHRs for short.
And as you also know, interoperability is nowhere near where it needs to be.
And as you surely must know, electronic health records are a big part of the problem.
We have international digital banking. We have self-driving cars. We have lightning-fast computers in our pockets. So why is it that sharing information from one EHR system to another is so hard?
There's no surefire answer to that question, but there are a couple of things that we can do.
We're going to point out the problems today, not just what's wrong with EHRs, but the real-world consequences of healthcare's lack of data sharing.
And we're going to show you how we got here, how the EHR came about and spread.
Because electronic health records can literally change the world, but that's only if healthcare makes good use of them.
And that is not happening. At least not yet. It could have been a devastating tragedy. So it's August 2017, and Dr. Sanjay Mishra, a physician, is traveling with his two kids.
He's at an airport when it happens. Mishra collapses.
He's in cardiac arrest and things look pretty bad.
You can imagine that it's probably quite the scene. We have a crowded airport and people are eager to leave for work or play, whatever it may be. And this man, this father, he just goes down right in front of his children.
But emergency responders jump on the scene and they deliver what care that they can, and then they bring him to a nearby hospital.
Keep in mind that this isn't his hospital. Mishra lives in Indiana, and he's in Pennsylvania, where he has little to no medical information on file. He's just out of state.
But the physicians at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, well, they run a bunch of tests on him. They're trying to figure out what the heck is going on.
Meanwhile, Mishra's wife drops everything and jumps on a plane.
His wife, by the way, is Seema Verma. You might know her as the head of CMS, the person who oversees all of Medicare and Medicaid.
Anyway, she gets to the hospital as quickly as she can.
And sooner than later, the doctors conclude that nothing major is wrong with Mishra. He's gonna be okay.
It's fantastic news. What more could anyone want to hear in a situation like this?
So he recovers, and then it comes time, eventually, for his family to return home, to go back to Indiana.
But this is, again, no ordinary family. They've got a physician and the CMS administrator, after all.
So before they go, Verma decides she wants one more thing.
Copies of her husband's medical records.
It seems like a simple request, right? I mean, you just go in and you pull the data from his stay and you email it over, something like that.
But it's really anything but simple. After Verma asks, the room just gets really quiet. Clinicians are looking at each other in a way that suggests that they really have no idea what to do.
And it takes a lot of talking by Verma to get them to act on this request.
And it takes a lot of time.
But finally, the hospital staff does get something to her.
5 sheets of paper and a CD-ROM.
So in terms of data, that is a discharge summary and a synopsis of Mishra's diagnosis.
But nothing about all the test results and new medical information that were uncovered during his hospital stay.
And the likelihood that these data will follow him home electronically to his doctors, to his state?
Not very high.
So Verma tells this story sometimes to drive home a couple of points.
The first one is that patients should really own and have access to their data.
And second, that interoperability, you know, how healthcare shares and accesses information, especially across state lines, has a long way to go.
Not until the 1920s that physicians begin using medical records.
Not electronic medical records. Medical records. Period.
By 1928, these things are beginning to really catch on. So the American College of Surgeons forms this new group. It's called the Association of Record Librarians of North America.
That's a snappy one. But anyway, its goal? Standardized health records. To make it so that doctors are using the same or very similar forms when they're jotting down patient info.
This is 90 years ago, guys. It's sort of like an early paper-based push towards interoperability.
Well, for many years, you know, paper records, they're as high-tech as it gets.
Even then, there are reports of physicians complaining about them, though. Filling these records out is really tedious work. It just doesn't feel like medicine.
But then something might click. You see, for decades, there's little in the way of noticeable technological innovation, at least for computing.
But then the 1960s roll around and the computer is born. It doesn't take long for visionaries to start thinking about how this creation could help healthcare.
And healthcare information.
Academic medical centers begin developing their own primitive forms of EHRs.
Mayo Clinic, you might have heard of it. That's an early pioneer in the space.
You've also got the problem-oriented medical record, which basically introduces the concept of using electronic tech to record patient information.
So all these smart folks are really just looking at how an EHR program could serve their individual institutions.
Still, by 1965, about 70 hospitals are undertaking some sort of EHR project.
And then the 1970s come, and the technology starts to take off even more.
In 1971, Lockheed Corporation develops what was then called a clinical information system. It's for El Camino Hospital, which goes on to serve Silicon Valley.
This EHR system is called Eclipsis, and it's a big deal because it's really fast. And it can also accommodate a bunch of different users, clinicians, at the same time.
Believe it or not, some form of this technology is still around today. Allscripts actually owns it.
Anyway, in 1972, the Regenstrief Institute develops what some experts consider to be the first real and true EHR system.
But no surprise here, it costs a ton of money and physicians just aren't too excited about it.
Same old story. So the EHR system basically gets confined to government hospitals and, I quote here, visionary institutes.
And time marches on.
And on and on. The invention of the computer was one thing, but the invention of the personal computer was a whole other beast.
Throw the internet in there and you have what was perhaps the world's greatest moment of disruption.
All of a sudden, everything is connected. People, businesses, ideas. I really mean everything.
And by the 1990s, some experts begin asking, why not medical records?
Because that's the one thing that's not really included in everything. So 1991 is still the dawn of the age of personal computing. But the forward-thinking folks at the Institute of Medicine can see where this is all going.
So they release a recommendation. Physicians should use computers in their practices. The tech just might improve patient care.
And nothing really comes of this in terms of laws or regulations.
But 5 years later, HIPAA comes around. HIPAA becomes law.
And it's all about privacy and protecting patients, right? Sure. But in its web of regulations, HIPAA pretty much requires doctors to start using computers.
These machines are all but vital to compliance issues surrounding disclosure and confidentiality.
So physicians and health systems, they get computers. And a few years later, things change yet again.
In the early 2000s, it becomes a lot easier to store and access information remotely. You don't need a huge hard drive or, God forbid, an on-site server for data storage. You can get and send it all online over the internet.
And this helps EHR adoption. You know, tech-friendly physicians and innovative health systems, They're all buying the tech that might one day allow them to go paperless.
And there are many vendors selling these systems.
Your Epics, your Cerners, your Allscripts.
They've been around for years developing their own EHR systems, but now it's looking like it's really their time to shine.
And they are their own EHR systems. They're proprietary and they don't often talk to each other. But under President Bush, the United States health IT budget doubles. The government starts backing all sorts of interoperability programs. New positions are created. Things are looking like they're gearing up for a big change.
And healthcare leaders begin calling for the total industry-wide adoption of EHRs.
EHRs still aren't ubiquitous in the U.S. It might sound strange, but if you look at the data, some clinics are still on paper. And many that do use EHRs still use paper in some capacity.
But by any measure, it's clear that EHR adoption has absolutely skyrocketed in recent years.
And that's largely because of the High Tech Act of 2009.
The country had just landed in a brutal recession, the worst in generations, and politicians, they had to act.
So they put together this big recovery plan, the famed economic stimulus package. How is that for some headline nostalgia? And this package, it includes the High Tech Act.
So the act provides nearly $20 billion in incentives for healthcare organizations that buy and begin to use EHR systems.
And after almost 100 years, this is supposed to help quell physicians' health record headaches. It is supposed to improve the care that patients receive, and it is supposed to help transform medicine.
And with all this public money that's available, it works. EHRs enter almost every doctor's office in this nation.
But it doesn't mean that things get magically better.
It doesn't mean that healthcare achieves interoperability.
Years of that proprietary software that we talked about, and piecemealed solutions, an obsession with shiny new toys, cultural resistance, and poor software design, they just all kind of screwed it up.
Physicians didn't like their EHRs.
They still don't like their EHRs.
And different EHRs in different states or made by different companies couldn't talk to each other.
And in some cases, different EHR systems in the same hospital still can't talk to each other.
So here we are with all the technology you could imagine, but still desperately searching for solutions.
Here we are at a point where the head of Medicare and Medicaid cannot even access her husband's health records.
So just how bad can the EHR problem get?
In the worst cases, a lack of information can result in really undesirable health outcomes. Maybe even death.
But the numbers aren't totally clear. We do know that delays in care often come with higher mortality rates, though.
And we also know that medication errors, botched diagnoses, and even certain forms of treatment complications have all been linked in some way to EHR systems.
And finally, we hear a lot about how EHRs contribute to physician burnout and maybe even suicide. Obviously, much more than a medical record goes into a tragic situation like that.
But the point is, despite widespread adoption across healthcare, EHRs aren't where they need to be.
No, they most certainly are not.
And today we've got a guest who understands this in more ways than one.
Janae Sharp is a health information technology expert. She also lost her physician husband to suicide, and she now tracks and tries to combat physician burnout and suicide through a project called the Sharp Index.
But today, we're welcoming her to Databook to share a different story.
And this story might not outline the full scope of problems baked into EHRs, but it's an anecdote that really gets at what's wrong with the exchange of medical information in 2018.
So, Janae Sharp, welcome back to Databook.
Thank you. I'm excited to talk about interoperability.
So, Janae, I understand that you experienced quite the mix-up at the hands of a lack of interoperability recently. Before we dive into the details, can you give us the one-sentence summary of what happened?
I moved from Pennsylvania to Utah, and my children's shot records never moved with me for a couple of years.
So, let's go back to the beginning. Where does this story start?
We lived in Scranton, Pennsylvania when my husband was in medical school. And after that, I moved to Utah and enrolled my kids with a pediatrician, tried to start them in preschool. My children were very young. 4, 2, and I think 6 months old. And the doctor requested their shot records and nothing happened. That happened many times. Like, I think we had at least 5 doctor requests for the shot records and never heard back. The pediatrician in Pennsylvania had retired. We just never got the shot records. No one could do it. And it was really frustrating because suddenly I had these 3 kids, which all of your shots happen when you're very young. And I was trying to enroll them in school, but I didn't have the shot records, but I really didn't want to duplicate their shots. So it was quite an adventure.
How, if at all, did you try to move your medical records over? Was there anything you could have done?
For me, it was a black hole. I had called them twice and realized that the doctor was retired. And then I called an earlier physician and got some records, but my pediatricians here couldn't get the records through like a standard request. And Pennsylvania doesn't have a statewide registry for immunizations. Utah State has a registry where all immunizations are in the state records through the HIE. Pennsylvania doesn't. So the schools would just say, well, you can just request them from the state and it should be really easy. But they didn't understand that every state is set up differently.
So you go and you see your kids, clinicians, and you know they want to vaccinate the kids again, even though the kids are already vaccinated. What did you say? What's going through your mind in this moment of confusion?
That was really interesting because we would ask them, you know, did you guys get the shot records yet? And they would say no and ask what we should do, if we should just revaccinate them, came up once. And I don't really think it's necessary to vaccinate more than once. Like, it's not like every time I move to a different state, I need new shots. So I filled out the paperwork to be an objector, like a conscious objector to vaccines for the school. So my kids could be in school and for the pediatrician. So every time I would go to any sort of appointment, they would ask me if I knew. I would remind them, we still haven't gotten the records. They would fill out a new request and I would tell them I'm an objector, essentially, even though I wasn't. And anything going out like the 5-year-old shots or later shots we could do, but nothing from infancy, which is the majority of your shots.
So basically what I'm hearing is that on paper you were an anti-vaxxer, but not in practice.
Yes, I was, which is really funny at the schools because I am not the type of person who wants to engage in like the anti-vaccine debate, but I got really involved because some of the moms that are anti-vaccine would want to talk to you about it. And it made for some really interesting conversations for me because I didn't want to be like, oh, well, I'm really actually pro-vaccine. I just can't take my kids to school today because I can't get their shot records. But I think you're wrong about vaccines. So I did have some very interesting experiences that were uncomfortable because I couldn't get the shot records, both with my pediatricians and with school leadership, because when schools find out that your kids are not vaccinated, many of them think it's irresponsible, even the principals. So I would say, no, we just couldn't get our shot records. And it was really interesting hearing how people would respond, both that don't vaccinate their kids and that are caring for kids. Guys, I have some super funny stories of people sending me like article after article about how awful vaccines are and me being like, I don't even know what to say. I don't want to talk about it.
So what ultimately ended up happening?
It was my friend who did detective work about getting the shot records and finally was able to get them. I told her the story and just said, I don't think we'll be able to get them. I've already called. I don't even know how many requests we've done at this point through multiple pediatricians and specialists. So I don't think we'll get them. And the doctor had retired And I was complaining about it online. Some people said you can complain to the state, which I know my pediatrician had already done. So she helped me get on the phone and wouldn't get off the phone until they faxed the records to my kid's school the same day. So it was the most humiliating thing, knowing that multiple pediatricians' offices and me had spent hours on the phone with people who claimed they didn't know how to do it. And she literally on the phone with me, like, got them within a day. And it was shocking because anytime a pediatrician retires, the records go to either like a hospital or to another pediatrician. But a lot of the time it's a different EHR system. It's a different method of looking it up. So the office staff, there's not really someone who's in charge of those legacy records. But she knew that. And it was also really amazing to watch someone just be persistent and say, no, my kid can't go back to school. So you need to find these records today, because that was really the option. And I didn't want to keep filling out the paperwork. Every year you have to fill out new conscious objector paperwork. So it was pretty amazing. But I can't take credit for it, really, because I wasn't the one who figured out how to make it happen in the end.
What does this whole episode say about the state of EHRs and interoperability? What should we take away from this?
It tells us a lot of things. It tells us that no one wants to be responsible for the electronic health record. No one wants to be the one who has to look up the legacy systems. And we haven't really incentivized that. Even with complaints to the state, that doesn't really affect the lives of the office staff who are actually sending the records. It doesn't really affect them. And I didn't have to fill out any forms in the end to actually get my records. I was on party line with my friend. It wasn't actually even me who got the records. So HIPAA, like all these privacy laws, oh, we have to fill out a form. That's just an excuse. Really, the problem with EHR interoperability is that we don't have someone on the other line who is incentivized to go get the records. Nothing to do with forms, nothing to do with permissions. It's all about who you get on the other line and whether or not they can get up and look up the record. Like going through the state way of petitions and fees and violations, no one had to pay that fee because the doctor was retired. So it did nothing. I was surprised. I was actually shocked that it's like, you don't have to fill out a form to get your records. You just have to stay on the phone until the lady who actually has to go look up the records is annoyed enough to go get the records.
How can healthcare leaders begin to improve EHRs and interoperability right now after listening to this podcast?
I really think some of the leadership will come from state levels. Utah has better shots in interoperability records because they had to. And I also think you have to incentivize the people who are responsible for interoperability. You have to incentivize the care coordinators to send over the records. The people who are actually doing the work have to be the people who are accountable and the people who are incentivized. State to state, you should be able to fill out a release form and have the records released. And every state needs to be responsible for sorting that out.
So before we go, I just want to thank you so much for listening to Databook. Again, we love putting this podcast together and we love that you're listening, but also maybe you should be reading. We are a healthcare analytics news podcast, and that is a magazine covering the nexus of medicine and tech. You can check us out online at hcanews.com. Right now, we have some really cool stories up. We've got a little feature on genetic data privacy, talk about hackers and all sorts of things that can go wrong or right in that regard. We have got a column about digital health research and how mHealth is kind of changing that. And we've got some features from the June book. Really, there's a bunch of great stuff. And I implore you to check it out, as well as our social media accounts, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, HCA_news, healthcare analytics news.
I definitely want to reach out and thank the studio here in New Jersey. We're MJH Studios. These guys have, they do some fantastic work, and we really appreciate the dedication to helping us make this podcast and bring it to life for all of the listeners out there.
We genuinely could not do it without them. So a big thank you to everybody. Also, by the way, back to us, we have a newsletter. You want to tell them a little bit about it?
Well, if you want the most highly refined information available in the health IT sphere, you can get it with this newsletter. If any of our listeners out there have any story ideas for us, we are all ears. We do not bite. Well, I can't promise that for Jack, but I don't bite.
I don't know if I bite or not.
He's a biter, guys.
Okay. Thanks for selling me out.
But if you have any story ideas, like I said, we're all ears. We really want to inundate ourselves in the community, and you guys are an integral part of that. We really appreciate all the input that you've given us so far, and are looking forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Yeah, just give us some good stories. Give us something to hunt down, whether it be for Databook or the website. We want to know what's really going on the ground and not just from the high level perspective. We want to know what you see in your job every day.
Feel free to slide into our DMs on Twitter.
Oh boy.
At @Thomas_Castles.
And I am at Jack Murtha.
So it's been another great episode of Databook, everybody. Thanks for tuning in.
Have a good weekend.